I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I am talking to Mourad Idris, assistant professor of politics at the University of Virginia. We're discussing his 2019 book, War for Peace, Genealogies of a Violent Ideal in Western and Islamic Thought from Oxford University Press. Idris works on the history of political thought, with emphasis on concepts of war and peace, language and politics, empire and post-colonialism, and Arabic and Islamic political thought. He has published several articles and is the co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Political Theory. Okay, so first of all, let me say to you, Mourad Idris, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm really delighted to be having this conversation with you.
Great. So, well, first of all, thanks for the book, Mourad. It was great. It has an amazing breadth and detail. It's a sweeping history of the moral ideal of peace and its relation to war in the West from Plato to Kant. And it also includes a number of Islamic thinkers as well. And this is not, we're not just talking about the greatest hits here, but also a lot of the supporting figures as well in the history. So it's a very impressive piece of work. We won't have time to discuss all of the thinkers, but we talked before about focusing on Plato, Hobbes, and Kant today. But in general, thanks for the impressive work. Let me ask you first about the motivation for the book. Why did you take on this project at this time?
Sure. So I started writing the book in 2009. It's based on my dissertation. And during this time, the U.S. was in the war on terror, and I'd actually just arrived to the U.S. a couple of years before. So we saw the language of war, and especially the language of war for peace, being delivered from on high, and it was also part of the public discourse. And during this time, and also since then, there have been numerous and incredibly important critiques of war, of the frame of war, but the idea of peace and the way that it was mobilized in relation to war seemed to be left intact. So we've had a number of critiques, but the idea of peace was nevertheless either being held up as a kind of aspiration, or it was being elided in some way. And something analogous happens in other contexts, including the relationship of France to Algeria, and more, say more recently, the relationship of Israeli discourses and American discourses to the question of Palestine, though that's not what this book is about. More broadly, it seemed to me that political theorists have done a fantastic job of dissecting the different concepts, ideas, and practices that we can say constitute the political, but peace, often this was in the name of peace, and peace itself seemed to be not on our radars as a political and potentially pernicious concept, one that's doing a lot of odd work. The second motivation, let's say, so I was writing this, right before I started writing this, I was reading Plato, I was reading Carl Schmitt, I was reading Ibn Khaldun, Kant, Hobbes, and I was noticing that there are these appeals to peace as a kind of ideal, as a kind of moral ideal, this kind of compulsion, I say in the book, to idealize peace. And there was a persistence of a structure surrounding peace that I wanted to highlight. So that's one of the reasons that I decided not to write a three-thinker book or a single context book, precisely to signal the pervasiveness and also the persistence of the oddity of the language of peace. And I'll be brief, just the third thing that motivated the book, and you alluded to this earlier in terms of thinking both about what we might call Western political thought and also Islamic political thought, is a response or maybe a reaction to the comparative turn in political theory and in philosophy, specifically with regards to Islam. So comparative has generally either meant the non-West, and this is something I've written on, or it's meant comparing discrete systems. So it's true that the subtitle of the book is Genealogies of a Violent Ideal in Western and Islamic Thought, but those are not categories that I think are innocent. They are categories that I think are often quite troubling. Specifically in the context of war and peace, we generally find ourselves either with the argument that Islam has something like just war theory as well, or Islam is a religion of peace. And I wanted to go beyond these two poles. And that's one of the reasons that the book is structured the way that it is. It's one of the reasons that I turn to these different thinkers.
And the way that you put the these various thinkers into dialogue, you know, it's not just one chapter devoted to one thinker. It's often a chapter that compares various thinkers across traditions. So it's good work there. So let's jump into your argument, which is, I'd say, a very strong and provocative and surprising argument, which let me see if I have it right, which goes something like this, that the moral ideal of peace that, as you say, sort of pervades the, you know, Western Islamic traditions is actually much more sinister than we think, in that it licenses and leads to great war and suffering. The quote that I like from the book is, "It authorizes war and sanitizes violence." Do I have that right? Maybe you probably can say it better than me, but you know, so, sort of, is that the overall picture? And maybe you could expand on it.
Yeah, sure. I think that does capture the core of the argument of the book, and also its motivation in many ways. The language of peace is one that we have tended within political theory and as, let's say, contemporary subjects to idealize and to uphold as both a necessary aspiration that defines what it means to be human, and also as the ultimate aim of political life. But it precisely as a political concept, it does all sorts of other work that we've tended to neglect, and it's precisely its relationship to war, violence, exclusion, dispossession, and to the production of hierarchies across the globe and within humanity that I think require greater attention and require that we perhaps start to question the compulsion to idealize peace in the way that we often do. So the larger argument, and I present these as sort of heuristics or as dynamic structures, it's that peace is parasitical, peace is provincial, peace is polemical. And when I say it's parasitical, I mean that we rarely talk about peace on its own. It's always peace and something else. So peace and security, peace and order, peace and law, peace and friendship. And the argument there is these different additives, these different supplements. In the book, I call them insinuates, and we can talk about that. These both rewrite the idea of peace and provide it with content, and they also act as hinges that facilitate the blurring of peace and war. And then I also say that it's provincial, and there I mean we tend to approach it as a kind of universal moral ideal. But when we look at the particular theorizations that thinkers from Plato to Qutb end up offering, we actually see that embedded within these theorizations are different anxieties, different desires, different fears, different hierarchies of humanity, different ways of structuring the globe that reflect very concrete and particular positions. So it's to do away with the universality there and the kind of moralization. And then finally, I say it's polemical. And there I mean that the idealization of peace grows out of particular antagonisms, but then in its deployment, it facilitates different hostilities. And we see this also in contemporary discourses. So we had Bush, for example, saying that his aim is a democratic peace. We had Obama telling us that peace is hard, while nonetheless authorizing a military intervention. We had Obama also telling us that the killing of bin Laden should be something that's welcomed by anyone who believes in peace and in human dignity. And it's precisely the way that then peace makes these different forms of hostility, these different forms of violence, the way that it bleeds into war and lends itself to violence that I'm trying to put on the table.
I think it's helpful to start off with some of these you know, contemporary concrete invocations of peace and contemporary American politics before we sort of jump back into the history to see where all this comes from. So, I mean, in the preface, you cite recent statements surrounding the war on terror, which is quite interesting, which Obama and Bush equally invoke this ideal of peace. And it, as you point out, sort of licenses certain kinds of violence. I wanted to ask you particularly about, say, earlier moments in American life. I'm thinking particularly the 1960s, where we had an earlier moment of the invocation of peace, saying the critique of Vietnam, civil mm-hmm. rights movement, Martin Luther King, and so forth. Is that different in your mind? I'm just trying to think about how to think about the, you know, the landscape of American history and the use of peace, and if it's univocal in the way that you think, or is there something different going on in those kinds of examples?
Yeah, I think there is. So the one thing that I do say in the book, and I actually do believe this, the language of peace can do all sorts of work, and it can also be a platform for critique. It can be a platform for calling for change. It can be a platform for speaking truth to power, trying to undo power in different ways. And I think some of the examples that you've highlighted are precisely that. And there are contexts also around the globe where we've seen the language of peace being mobilized precisely along these more critical lines. So I want to say two things on that, though. The first is whether it's Martin Luther King or Gandhi or Du Bois or Fanon, they themselves also offer a different moment, a diagnosis of how the ideal of peace, when it's presented from a position of power, when it's presented from the empire or from the state, that's where it becomes troubling. That's where it does the kinds of things that I'm describing. So I think that it's important to always have in view who the speaker is and what their position is in relation to power more broadly. And then the second thing that I'd want to highlight, the language of peace in relation to war, and specifically the now kind of commonplace acknowledgement that peace blurs into war and is in some ways complicit in the perpetuation of violence and exclusion, that goes by the wayside the moment that we orient ourselves towards peace as a position of critique. So part of it for me is trying to bring all of this together in such a way that I would acknowledge the piece can offer a space of resistance, but that we need to be careful because this is also the language that sanitizes violence and sanitizes different formations of empire. All of this then is to say there's a difference between someone who's dispossessed calling for peace and justice and say the state calling for peace and security. And I would want to highlight that difference while nonetheless asking what would it mean for this critique to be about peace and security, or sorry, to be about peace and justice rather than a call for justice on its own.
I mean, so resistance movements, they can be violent and they can be nonviolent. So resistance movements call for peace sometimes as well, and in calling for peace they license suffering in the same way that states might, right? I'm just trying to figure out what it is about the invocation of peace that generates this, the move for the ideal of peace to move towards the parasitical, provincial, and polemical character, right? What is it, why is it that Martin Luther King and the like can be immune to the way in which peace can move in that direction, whereas, you know, Obama and Bush and the like aren't?
Yeah, I think that a large part of it is about the relationship of the speaker to power and what exactly mm-hmm. the demand of peace is. So we can imagine different critiques that call for peace and equality, or peace and justice, or peace and human dignity. And there is going to be some overlap in terms of how peace operates, at least in the way that I schematize it in the book, and that this is a... often a parasitical structure in the way that I've described it. It's peace and something else. It re-entrenches the idealization of peace precisely as the moral ideal that we ought to be sort of cathecting in and supporting in different ways. But the way that peace presents itself in the contemporary age, and I think this is where it's peculiar in relation to some other ideals, is it's something of a void, and it's particularly susceptible to, or let's say appropriate for, the introduction or the smuggling in of all sorts of other ideals and all sorts of other desires. So in that sense, it's not something that I think is inherent to the idea of peace. I think it's about its uses, it's about its deployments, it's about its genealogies. And that's part of why in the book I end with three other possible ways of conceptualizing peace, ones that don't necessarily get us outside of the frame of war. I think that's part of my broader critique, that thinking about peace outside the frame of war is not only difficult, but perhaps also unworkable. But it's to say that once we accept that this blurring of war and peace defines the contemporary age and seems to be a dominant way in which it has figured in the history of political thought and in the history of political discourses, what might we do with that idea still? What kind of structure of peace can we come to imagine? And for me, this is a structure of peace that gives up on the desire for certainty, on the desire for mastery. It's one where we might be open to its own finitude. It's one where we would not insist upon consensus, on agreement, on on demanding the desire for peace, and on demanding that people avow their commitment to peace. That's part of the masking work that I think peace does.
Yeah, that's very helpful. So we'll return to that at the end. I hope we'll have time for that. Yeah, because that's very, very suggestive. Let me dive a little bit more into the three different concepts that are related to peace. I mean, what you've been saying is very helpful, because it's not that you're against peace. So you're pro peace, but as long as it's directed in the right sort of way, that the invocation of peace in the historical thinkers and in the contemporary political figures that we've already mentioned have these three different features to them, you say. The first is the parasitical nature of peace, in which peace is internally connected with various other goodies. I think things like friendship, justice, the respect for law. And this appears, as you say, in a number of thinkers across the tradition. And that strikes me, I mean, when thinking about that, that strikes me as right when thinking about peace, because I guess one of the things I'm wondering is why you call it parasitical, because another way to think about it is just these thinkers are trying to figure out what the conditions or preconditions are for peace. And in order to have peace, human beings need to demonstrate friendship, justice, and the respect for law from one another. So maybe you say a little bit, what are you getting at when you use the term parasitical in particular?
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the easiest places to turn for that is, or perhaps one of the clearest instances of this is Aquinas. So Aquinas in question, 29, I want to say, Aquinas says, peace is concord, but with something else added into it. And for me, it's these additives, acknowledging that they are additives, that they are not necessary or logically implied. That's part of the move that I'm trying to make, to denaturalize the association of peace with, friendship, or peace with security, or peace with unity, precisely to say that these are in fact different ideas, but then there's a way that associating them together ends up overriding what peace is, either by offering, as you put it, preconditions for peace, or at the same time by indicating or by offering a hinge, a blurring into war. So the easiest way, I think, to see this is with the language of security as well, where peace is, say, the phrase peace and security, you end up with the demand for security facilitating different kinds of war. So what we insert into peace can itself be smuggling in different formations of war and of violence. And I think that's precisely where I would say that the frame of anti-peace and pro-peace, sort of the two possibilities, ends up obscuring quite a bit when it comes to why it is that we nonetheless want to hold on to the desire or the demand to frame what it means to be human, what it means to be a moral agent in terms of this particular desire. And there's something very Nietzschean about the interrogation there in the book. I actually open with Nietzsche and the idea that the things that we think are good and that we revere are, as he puts it, insidiously related, tied to, and involved with their seemingly opposite things, maybe even one with them. So that's part of what the parasitical, I think, makes possible for us when we're trying to diagnose and critique these kinds of structures.
Let me see if I have this, if I grasp this. So it's the, to understand peace in some ways is a kind of negative ideal. I think you point this out in the book. It can be cast at a negative ideal, that is a cessation of war. But if we're trying to think about what the positive features of peace would be, like what is a society in which we can have perpetual peace in Kant's terms, then we have to start smuggling in this sense, or adding little parasites, as you say, to try to figure out what that kind of society would be. And I guess this is one way in which the parasitical nature shades into the provincial, which is the vision of the positive community of peace is going to be fairly provincial. It's going to reflect the sort of standpoint of the thinker or the political agent. And then they're going to look on their adversaries on the rest of the world through that particular lens and then condemn them for their failing to live up to that, and then licensing war. So is that the way, is that the story? Do I have that
right? Yeah, I think that's,
That kind of sort of connects the parasitical and the provincial, which is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that does capture that does capture the essence of it. The so the idea behind the provincial is that as these different additives or these different insinuates are inserted into peace, and as they come to appear as though they'd always, in a sense, been associated with it or are requirements for it, there we end up with these different anxieties, these different desires, but also these different hierarchies of humanity emerging. So we can see this, for example, with Erasmus, who is sort of considered one of the foremost philosophers of peace. There's a kind of debate about him in relation to pacifism. But the core of it is he actually ends up offering us a theory of peace and unity, peace and friendship that comes at the end, or that refers back in the end to a certain understanding of Christian community and to a certain hierarchy of humanity that reflects what I call his political theology. So there the question becomes, what is the relationship of this construction of peace to the Ottoman Empire, or what thinkers in the Renaissance and the Reformation refer to as the Turk, and often as the Great Scourge. The idea there is we have these thinkers that are thinking about about the globe, about peace in relation to the globe, but then end up presenting something that seems to exceed that particular political position while nonetheless remaining constricted and contained within it. But it sort of masks that relationship. So for me, when I say provincial, I'm trying to highlight how theorizations of peace draw different maps of the globe, different hierarchies within humanity. And then within these, we can ask about who exactly is presented as the primary subject of peace, who's presented as its candidate, and who's excluded from it. When we look at a map, we can ask which places are presented as the natural spaces of peace, and which ones are its peripheries, and which ones are simply masked over or absent. And at the same time, which are the places that are marked for pacification, which are the ones that are by default, in a sense, allowed to wage what is perceived as legitimate warfare, and which ones are spaces out of which illegitimate warfare arises. For me, this is less a diagnosis in terms of the language of law and more about the politics of the perspectivism that ends up presenting as universal something that is actually quite particular and provincial.
Often in order to theorize these things, we develop certain kinds of dichotomies, right, between the just and the unjust enemy, or just and unjust wars and so forth, or barbarians and Greeks. And in order to develop these dichotomies, you need an other. You need some kind of community that that's going to embody all the bad stuff that you want to distinguish from your good ideal. And so you then are able to invest it in a particular community that you don't know much about. So we'll talk about Plato's laws in a minute, but the Greeks and the barbarians are a good example there. And then in the sort of broad Christian tradition that you talk about, the Islamic world, of course, plays a large looming role over and against it. So I mean that this is very helpful because it helps for me to understand this. Sort of, we could think about peace leading to war in a couple different ways. I mean, one is the sort of more, I guess, familiar cynical use of peace. If you think about like a cynical politician who just wants to go to war with another country and sort of invokes peace in order to use that as a means to an end. And it seems to me that's what you're talking about in the polemical, the polemical concept. So we can transition to that. But here in the parasitical and provincial notions, what you're referring to is a way in which peace can slide into war in a kind of, I guess you could say, an innocent way. That is, through the very types of conceptualizations that human beings are naturally prone to. So there, although maybe you want to say that there's a connection between those two. I mean, does that make sense, that kind of distinction between a more sort of cynical, instrumental use of peace and then a kind of moralized peace that is nonetheless still has the kind of same effect?
Mm-hmm. No, I see what you mean. And I think it's right to say that the book's diagnosis is not of the kind of cynical uses or what in the book I highlight as the what people call the abuses and the misuses of peace, but more about how peace slides on its own in its own operations in its ordinary political deployments into war, that this is something that's internal to its structure and internal to its history, without kind of thinking about the or without attributing cynical or bad intentions to the different agents there. For the polemical, there is a way that it's very easy when we see a politician or a president or a philosopher talking about the enemies of peace to then highlight that as a abuse, as a misuse of the concept. And that's actually the dominant way, I think, in which a lot of critics have approached those kinds of invocations. I'm trying to make a somewhat different argument, precisely by saying that there's a constitutive aggression that's embedded within the logic of peace as a moral ideal, that precisely through its hinges or its insinuates, precisely through the maps of the world that it ends up drawing, or that we end up drawing through it, we end up with war, antagonism, and hostility being internal to the operations of peace. So the idea here is more than mere rhetoric, more than simply the identification of some groups as enemies. theorizations of peace point to particular groups that are, through the very theorization, constructed as, let's say, destructive, as the antithesis of peace, as beyond the possibility of waging any kind of justifiable war, or as outside of the legitimate structures of politics and of peace itself. Sometimes this means that we would describe them through the language of law. So these would be unlawful enemies. Sometimes it's the language of justice. These would be inherently unjust enemies. Sometimes it's through the language of friendship. So either enemies that cannot enter into the possibility of friendship, which in some of these theories is considered the precondition for peace, or who need to undergo some dramatic conversion, some dramatic transformation before we can come to understand them as peaceful, or as peace-loving, or as joining with us in peace. So the idea here is the idea of peace is a weapon. And I think that this in a way refers back to our initial conversation about the different kinds of deployments of peace, whether those that are critical or those that are from positions of power. And it's precisely saying peace is a weapon.
Maybe you'd say a little bit about how your argument stands to the just war tradition. I suspect that it's critical of it, right, in the way that the just war tradition invokes a kind of universalizing reason or rationalism, which, in your view, is a kind of mask of power, right?
Yeah, precisely. So the way that I see it, just war theory did have at some point the potential to speak truth to power, but just war theory has also become the idiom of now it's become the idiom of power. It's the idiom of the military. It's the idiom of the state, and its pretensions to universality and to this tendency to moralize, this tendency to offer a blueprint or a map for armies being able to present themselves as the most ethical or the most moral army in the world. That, for me, is part of the obfuscation and the moralization that this other tradition ends up offering. It's also the way that in its own architecture, even as just war theory presents itself as universal, as offering a way of judging different wars as either just or as unjust, it's skewed, it's tilted in favor of certain kinds of actors, certain kinds of political arrangements, and against others. So for me, that's one of the central limitations of attempting to moralize the relationship between war and peace. And I should add that just war theory is probably the primary idiom today in which the idea of war for peace is often offered. And it's one that often says, if one does not accept this morality as universal, as in some way as the parameters for engaging with others in discourse, then I think the way that Walter puts it is anyone who asks, what is this morality of yours, has excluded themselves or excommunicated themselves from the comfortable world of moral agreement and the wider world of agreement, justification, and criticism. And that's precisely the kind of maneuver that I'm describing as problematic. And the book basically is trying to offer an alternative way of thinking about the relationship of war, peace, critique, and history more broadly.
Yeah, so, but isn't it an improvement when states internalize the just war tradition as opposed to, I mean, the older way of doing things would have been the Melian dialogues, I suppose, right? Where it's just the Athenians say, we're going to do this because we're stronger. Isn't it better that states internalize that tradition? I mean, because then presumably one might say, yeah, okay, Murad, you're right. We don't have justice quite right. So let's just sort of expand or, you know, further universalize our view. We just don't have the, you know, in other words, the just war tradition remains. It's just what you're doing would be expanding the scope of the just war tradition further. Or is that not right?
So the way that I see just war as having a very different task, and maybe the best person on this for me is Eyal Wiseman in The Least of All Possible Evils, and also Talal Asad in On Suicide Bombing, where the parameters that just war theory puts forward, whether it's about proportionality or about restraint, these are very easily taken up by states, not then in order to, or not with the consequence of having more humane wars, but with the consequence of allowing them to present themselves as more humane and more ethical. When I think at the end of the day, if we were to have a closer look, I think we would see that precisely because it is the idiom of the powerful, the just war theory loses its critical edge. Now, don't get me wrong. There was an article recently in Humanity by Jessica White, I believe, that details how the idea of a just war and the idea of an unjust war was deployed by anti-colonial thinkers as a critique of empire prior to this. So again, for me, it's not something that's inherent to these ideas, but rather a diagnosis of where they are relative to the formations and the structures of power that we inhabit at this particular moment.
Yeah, that's good. That's helpful. Let's move on to talk about, I think I've been giving the wrong impression, which is I'm sort of pushing you on some of these larger conceptual issues. Much of the book is a very careful and interesting analysis of a number of different texts and their views about war and peace. So let's talk about a few of them, the ones that are probably most familiar. To start with, you have your first chapter is about Plato's Laws, which is a dialogue as we know that about an Athenian stranger, a Spartan and a Cretan who are walking towards the caves of Zeus and are discussing, among other things, a plan for a new colony of Crete, and one of the things that comes up quite early in the book is I think it's in the context of their discussion about the purpose of the polis. The Athenian stranger asks Clinias and Megalus what the purpose of some of their institutions are, and they respond that it's for excellence in war. And so part of the trajectory of the first couple books of the Laws is that the Athenian stranger tries to inject more peace, I take it, into their attitudes to try to reform or soften their warlike attitude, perhaps. It's one way to look at it. Maybe you could say a little bit about your reading of this, you know, the similarities and differences between Clinias and Megalus and the Athenian stranger, and how this discussion brings out the kind of themes that you're talking about.
Thanks. So we have the Athenian Stranger and Cleinias and Megalus. And precisely after that question about the purpose of the different institutions, Cleinias says these are oriented towards war. And his example of an institution that is for the sake of victory in war is common meals, so eating together. And the Athenian Stranger pushes him on this so that he wants to know who exactly is at war with who, and we end up with polis against polis, we end up with neighborhood against neighborhood, we end up with household against household, and then we end up with person against person. And for me, there's an important elision there, because if this is a kind of nesting of war from a large unit, and then within each unit, sort of its constitutive parts, and then within those, its constitutive parts, rather than going from household against household to person against person, the aesthetics of this nesting would require the war of family member against family member within the same household, whether it's master and slave, brother against brother, sister against sister, parent against child, or parent against parent. And it's the elision of brother against brother that I think we see becomes absolutely central just a couple of passages later, where the Athenian presents his two interlocutors with another hypothetical, where he says, okay, let's we now have this idea that each person is at war with himself, but let's take it another direction. You have this group of brothers and another group of brothers, and I think it's central that they are brothers, who are, they've had a disagreement. Some of them are just and the others are unjust. What should we do? What should a lawmaker or a judge do in this regard? Should he have the unjust ones eliminated? Should he have the just ones rule over the unjust ones? Or should he reconcile them? And suddenly, from this vision of war is a natural state, it is perpetual, and it pervades these different kinds of domains, we have the interlocutors suddenly saying, no, they need to be reconciled. And through that, the Athenian then smuggles in, precisely through this kind of parasitical structure that I've described, the idea that what's necessary is peace and friendship, and that this is the work of the law, which is abstracted then out of the judge. And that's then a way that Plato's Laws presents us with a particular theory of friendship grounded in fraternity. It's the way that it presents us with peace and friendship and law and eventually and unity as the primary way to understand peace if we are to overcome or look beyond an idea of perpetual and natural war. And it's also the way that the Persian Empire gets written out, both from Cleinias's different schematizations of war and also the Athenian Stranger's binding of peace to the polis. And I would want to highlight that the at this point, the Athenian Persian Empire was a bureaucratically advanced and vast series of polities, one that certainly played a crucial role in the different wars that involved the Greek city-states in relation to one another. So then part of the questioning of the book is what does the theorization of peace license in relation to these different kinds of exclusions, those that are within the household, those that are beyond the polis, and those that are defining what it means to be a peace-desiring human.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering about the point about the provincial character of the appeal to the polis in particular. I mean, I found this point quite interesting in your chapter. I mean, one of the things that I guess one might say about it is, you know, the emphasis certainly in Plato and certainly in Aristotle on the need for a small regime. I mean, the laws even details, you know, the exact number of different plots of land and their relationship to one another, precisely in order to foster that sort of friendship. Because as soon as you get into larger regimes, you know, the claim goes and into, like, you know, the level of the Persian and into empires, you start to see the kind of internal conflict, internal divisions among fellow citizens. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I take that as a fairly straightforward argument in ancient political thought about the need for a small regime in order to maintain stability. What's missing there, though?
So, I think one of the crucial things that goes unremarked in that centering of the polis and what the polis enables is precisely the Plato and Aristotle and others were speaking in the name of the human, speaking in the name of the natural, speaking in the name of the political. And it's not a straightforward exclusion of the Persian Empire in Plato. There are a number of different discussions of the Persians and the barbarians throughout, but nonetheless, it's the impulse for universalization ends up eliding that we really are talking about we really are just talking about the polis. We really are just talking about the Greeks and the construction of the globe there ends up presenting us with a hierarchy of humanity that's offered precisely through the idiom and the idealization of peace. I think that that's what's missing. It's the relationship of this universality to the ambivalences surrounding non-polis life or extra-polis life.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, in the, I think you allude to the Republic and the way that even Socrates will talk about Greeks versus barbarians and sort of carve up the world in that way. I mean, I suppose one might, I mean, the question ultimately on this, and this is, so that it gets questions of the dramatic character of the dialogues, which is, you know, how much is the Athenian stranger in this dialogue and then Socrates in the Republic appealing to certain kinds of prejudices of the Greek people and trying to explode them. I mean, I take it your claim is that he might be playing on certain prejudices, but reinforcing them. But I suppose one might see the effort of a Socrates or an Athenian stranger to sort of get his interlocutors to think more universally.
I think that's certainly valid reading. So I think there's a way of reading the laws as mounting a series of critiques about these different oppositions. And there's a way of also reading the Republic precisely as doing that kind of work, where in a sense, one could say the presence of the Persian Empire, whether when it's designated as Asia or as the Great King, as it often was in Greek discourses, that it's the absence is, or that these are notable precisely through the absence from the different schematizations or through the impossibility or just untenable way that the binaries are often presented. For me, the way that I approach the dialogues, it's less about the intentions and less about the work that the text does to the reader. And one might say, and I'd be happy to say this about my own reading, that ultimately the laws can lend itself to a critical appraisal of peace. One could read the laws as saying there's actually some really odd moments where we have peace suddenly becoming peace and friendship, or as I mentioned earlier, becoming peace and friendship and law, and then becoming peace and friendship and law and unity, precisely as highlighting the parasitical structure and in drawing attention to it, asking us in a way or inviting us to be critical of it. I don't go in that direction. I don't go into the question of Plato's audience and Plato's intentions, though I do take Foucault's joke very seriously that we really need to be wary of blaming poor old Plato for everything that we don't like.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm thinking of other places too. And I mean, Socrates is often quite critical of Athenian empire and Athenian militarism. I mean, you think the Apology and the way that he you know, refuses to do his civic duty in the cases in which, you know, these generals are going to be executed. The Gorgias is a sort of implicit criticism of the Peloponnesian War, Athenian strategy there. I mean, you know, the law seems to be in the wake of the Persian War, and could be read in a similar sort of way as a sort of critique of, you know, Cretan and Spartan militarism. So I mean it's just as interesting how I mean, this goes to the richness of Plato, how it can be read both as a sort of in a critical lens, but also, you know, as you know, employing peace in order to sort of criticize the warlike, but also sort of licensing a new form of the moral ideal of peace that can have these features that you're talking about.
Yeah, and yeah, I think that's exactly right. I'd also add that part of what's interesting is the history of the laws. So most of the thinkers, not all, but most of the thinkers that are in the book are, they cite the laws at different points. And there's an interesting way that Clanius, a really sort of surprising and perhaps even somewhat perverse way, given the text can in fact, given how the text can in fact be read as a critique, there's a way that Clanius and the Athenian strangers prodding of him, how they end up being the protagonists in a sense when the text is cited. So you have, in a really fascinating moment, you have Pufendorf saying that Hobbes is really not as original as people have made it out to be. His idea that there is a natural or perpetual war among all people was something first detailed by Plato in the Laws. It's actually detailed by Plato's character Clanius in the Laws, right? That's an important distinction. But then you also have Grotius, you have Gentili, you have people from the Laws of Nations appealing to Plato's Laws as one of the texts that presents us with this kind of timeless truth that war is for the sake of peace. So the life of the text, and at least within the corpus of, let's say, what's often canonized as the foundational texts of political theory, ends up being less the critical reading and more this other one.
Well, that's great. I mean, let's talk about Kant, because sorry, for the sake of time, let's skip over Hobbes. It sort of breaks my heart to do it, maybe if there's time, we'll come back. But people who listen to this podcast enough know that I'm obsessed with Kant, so gotta talk about him. Another reason to go to Kant is that we may have the same discussion here with Kant as we did with Plato, which is that I tend to read him, I guess, in what has become more of the received reading of Kant, associated with people like Sankarmuthu, that Kant is a critic of European colonialism, that can be read in this critical vein, in the same way that we might think of Plato as being, a sort of critical voice against political power. Kant might be understood as and he does have a lot of these remarks in Perpetual Peace, Metaphysics and Morals, where he has some very sharp criticisms of European colonialism, that it's a sort of naked grab for power. So, but you read him interestingly as nevertheless sort of further entrenching colonialism and licensing further violence and war in his vision of perpetual peace. So maybe you can just lay that out. I mean, there are a couple different parts to it, but let me just in general, what's the reading?
Sure. So the literature on Kant and colonialism tends to have roughly two different parts. One part is about how the early Kant was a racist and perhaps even supported colonialism, and how then the later Kant, say of Perpetual Peace, has changed his mind and now is critical of colonialism. The other part of it is critics who have read how the structure of Kant's thought and Perpetual Peace, but also the Universal History from a little bit earlier, how the kind of teleology that's presented ends up re-entrenching a developmental teleology. And part of what I'm trying to do is, in a way, on the one hand, looking beyond the particular affirmations or avowals or declarations that Kant might give us about where he stands, and more about the actual sources and slippages and references to these various figures that are cropping up across the corpus, both the early Kant and also the late Kant, to kind of highlight that there is actually quite a bit of continuity in this, the kind of the idea of a absolutely sharp break that then redeems or rehabilitates Kant, I think, has to gloss over quite a bit, particularly when it comes to the Arabian Bedouin. So Kant in some texts describes Arabian Bedouins as the paragons of hospitality. He links hospitality to, in a kind of weird moment, to the demand for security in the Arabian Bedouin's tent. And then in Perpetual Peace, the Arabian Bedouin becomes the antithesis of hospitality because of his plunder. And for me, it's the both the going back and forth, the kind of ambivalence, but also the political economy that is implied in how Kant is understanding hospitality and understanding the globe, that have generally gone unnoticed. So in a previous draft of Perpetual Peace, the Arabian Bedouin was actually the most hospitable creature still, rather than being the most inhospitable. And Similarly, when we get to this question of political economy, for me, these the ambiguities that are in Perpetual Peace, the ambivalences that are in these discussions, are at the end of the day openings into how, if not Kant himself, then the structure that he puts forward, how this itself ends up facilitating or enabling or let's say licensing different forms of colonial thought, precisely in diagnosing, for example, the Arabian Bedouin as developmentally behind, as only engaging in plunder, and as having precisely the wrong kind of political economy, the wrong kind of internal organization. So they're kind of thrown out of history in a sense. In addition to that, there's one of my favorite phrases in Perpetual Peace is where Kant is describing the habitation of the earth. And he says that people sort of went all over the planet thanks to ships and camels, ships of the desert. And when we look at the genealogy of this phrase, when we look at its history and its occurrence in contemporaneous and earlier sources to which Kant would have potentially had exposure, and these include travel narratives, these include Semitic philology, and as I detail in the book, it's also potentially a translation from a pre-Islamic poem, because this is actually a common trope in Orientalism. So then part of what goes unnoticed is how Orientalism and its own understanding of the globe, its own understanding of the Arab, its own understanding of the Muslim may in some way be structuring how Kant is thinking about the globe itself through precisely these kinds of small phrases, these kinds of slippages, as I would say.
The Bedouin tribes, I mean, this is a very... I found this very illuminating. I mean, it was, I had no idea that, you know, Kant had this very ambiguous view about the Bedouins. This is quite interesting. I mean, because he does have, yes, this famous remark in Perpetual Peace about them as a sort of exemplars of inhospitable behavior. I mean, I guess one thing to say about that, though, is that this, you know, you might say that this is a critique of the letter rather than the spirit of Kant's philosophy, because it's based on what Kant was reading. So Kant, you know, presumably read some stuff in, you know, 1795 that said, oh, turns out looks like the Bedouins are horrible people after all. You didn't know that, Kant. So Kant just, you know, he just changed his mind. You're okay. So, you know, I could fit them into my system here. Well, so we could present Kant with different, you know, more enlightened or updated version of the narrative history, and then he might say, okay, well then get rid of the Bedouins from this example. So I mean, I guess I guess I'm not seeing the sort of broader worry there. I mean, so he includes pirates too, and you know, pirates are bad people. There's, you know, so that maybe Kant would like retreat to pirates rather than the Bedouin tribe.
Yeah, so I think part of it is reading the text in relation to history and in relation to context, right? So for the Arabian Bedouins, there's a crucial way that discourses about them, discourses about Bedouins in relation to developmentalism, in relation to plunder, actually were deployed by colonial powers and by modern states precisely in order to expropriate, dispossess, and engage in various forms of violence that don't end up with the name plunder, that actually end up being sanitized in various ways. And the other part of it is, when we when we look at what Kant is up to, at least in the way that I read him, there's a presentation of these different concepts, these different groupings, these different activities: plunder, tribe, state, federation, as in some way neutral, as in some way innocent. What we don't get in Kant, I think, is an accounting of how these different ideas grow out of particular political constellations, and then how they themselves are deployed or enable different kinds of political exclusions, political dispossession, things of the sort. So that's what I mean when I say that there's these ambiguities and these ambivalences, and that they're productive. It's less that Kant himself is a it's less about his intentions and whether he's a imperial thinker or an anti-imperial thinker, and more about what the grammar of peace that he's putting forward, what its different parts end up doing out in the world. And for me, this is particularly significant because what Kant is giving us is a kind of teleology, a kind of aspirational structure of peace that he ends up offering in opposition to the truce, precisely because the truce is something that is limited, it's something that's finite, it's something that only ends up opening itself up to war. And what I am trying to highlight is how this desire for this desire for certainty, this desire for mastery over the very structures of violence and of war, itself comes with an entire host of assumptions about humanity and its hierarchies, about the globe and its different zones, about legitimate and illegitimate political economies, without taking account of the discursive work that these different formations are implicated in, and that they then end up enabling. So it's more than just the textual, I guess, is what I mean.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, and I could see the connection back. I mean, the first point you raised was about the teleology in Kant's thought, or his philosophy of history, broadly understood as his is progressive, so that envisions humanity as moving roughly from a state of nature to civil states, ultimately to a universal federation and to perpetual peace. And I take, you know, the point, I take your point is, well, so that that progressive story sees sort of Europe as the end state of history or whatever, and so is necessarily exclusive of political arrangements that don't fit the European model. I mean, this is, you know, this is a critique that Herder, the, you know, Kant's own student, mm-hmm. Herder was making at the time, which is, you know, you don't take account of the broad universe of things. I mean, the couple things to say about that, though. I mean, one thing is that, you know, the motivation for Kant's teleology is quite interesting. This is something I'm working on right now, because I think put your finger on it, which is that Kant is quite interested in establishing some meaning or purpose to human existence, that the meaning or purpose of human existence is in some sense in doubt in a sort of secular world. Once we leave the sort of bounds of religion, which establishes human beings' place in the world, it's not clear what our place in the world is, and indeed the value of human existence is in some sense in doubt. If you look back in the history of humanity, it is a pretty sad and horrible story. I think of sometimes you watch these science fiction movies, and when the robots become self-aware and they look back at the history of humanity and declare how humanity is a sad and pathetic and warlike and aggressive species. Kant's doing a similar thing and wondering about how is it possible to justify human existence, to offer a kind of theodicy for for human life. Anyway, I'm going on too long. I mean, I wonder what you think about. I mean, you sort of have, you put your finger on that, but I take it you don't think that that's something of a justifiable political project, or that it leads to worse abuses than the benefits that it supplies.
Yeah, I think exactly what you just said at the end there. The desire to supply not a personal, not even a kind of self-avowedly particular, but a kind of universal and overarching sense that here is the purpose of our existence, here is the direction in which we not necessarily, but should hope to be moving. This ends up doing all sorts of political work that I wouldn't want to blame Kant for, but that is certainly part of the structure of the text and the kind of the broader discourses within which it's embedded and that it has enabled. So to go back for a second, just about how Kant's understanding of history, of meaning, of purpose, and of these different entities that he's identifying and these different practices. In each of the sections on Kant, part of what I try to highlight is precisely that these not only are these terms not neutral, but the question of power that is elided in a lot of Kant's writings is who decides? Who decides what a tribe is? Who decides what plunder is? Who decides what the purpose of the species is? Who decides what counts as as hospitality versus as inhospitality? And for me, these are political and historical concrete questions that answering them in the realm of moral philosophy or in the realm of the ethical doesn't actually undo that political work. It doesn't end up providing an answer to it, and it doesn't end up by any means making these structures it may end up masking them, it may end up sanitizing them, but it doesn't actually it doesn't actually prevent a bulwark against what they end up doing. If anything, I think that they're far too easily appropriated towards these other ends. And just on the, you mentioned theodicy, and yeah, I just want to say one small thing on that. The part of what's interesting to me about Kant and about putting Kant's vision of perpetual peace in the book, I read him alongside the Islamist Sayyid Qutb, who wrote a text called Universal Peace and Islam. It's precisely the relationship of what now is understood as a secular text to theology, and in its relationship to theology, the different kinds of things that then it smuggles in, the different ways that its ambiguous secularization, which is ambiguous, ends up presenting us precisely with these different structures of hierarchies within humanity and these different understandings of history that seem to be or that present themselves as universal and yet nonetheless grow out of a they deny their own provincialism.
The comparison between Kant and Qutb is quite interesting in that chapter. I mean, so just to go back on the, yeah, I mean, I sort of the political upshot of Kant's view in the sort of who decides question is a good one. Although I guess still here, I would find myself on Kant's side in a certain sense, because he is the philosopher of universal, or say, you know, sort of global international organizations. And so the question always of who decides for Kant has always got to be, well, it's got to be up to some kind of partnership or federation of a greater and greater scope of nations. So, you know, he's Kant is a critic of unilateralism, of making America great again, or, you know, putting America first, as it were, right? Or putting any one particular community first, that there's a kind of an emphasis on the humility of the judgment of any one country and the gradual expanding of the circle of humanity to include everyone in the judgment about who's just and who's unjust, right? So I actually find that somewhat attractive. I mean, I can understand the concern that, look, any one instantiation of this international organization is going to have power relations in which, you know, more powerful states are going to wield more power over others. Although, you know, Kant is attentive to those sorts of things too, that the you know, he talks about the rich and the poor, and the rich need to be aware of their historical oppression over the poor and sort of try to mask their contributions and so forth. And he's a student of Rousseau, Kant's a student of Rousseau, and so there's a sort of emphasis on equality that stands behind his work. So I'm still a Kantian in at the end of the day here. What am I missing?
So I think you can still be a Kantian.
Thank you.
I think that there is something missing from that, and it's and again, I think this is a question of reading texts either for the moral structure that they end up providing, or reading them in relation to politics and history. I don't want to draw that division too sharply, but I think it telegraphs what I'm trying to get at. And it's, so for example, when Kant says that states ought not to interfere in the affairs of other states unless they reach a critical point, for me, it's this idea that now there's an opening for the critical point. And I'm sure that we could say, look, what Kant's intentions here would be to say that in severe cases of humanitarian suffering or something of the sort, then surely one ought to be able to intervene. But this is never a kind of neutral question. There's the who diagnoses these conflicts, and who thereby ends up policing the globe, who ends up deciding when and where non-intervention can apply or no longer applies. These are political questions that can't, I think, be approached purely from the perspective of the moral or the ethical in abstract, precisely because they've been so productive historically in the histories of dispossession, exclusion, and empire. So in this sense, the grammar that Kant is, you could say, either putting forward or symptomatic of, is one that I don't think gets us as far as we might want to get. Similarly, when he talks about the different structure of history that he's put forward, and here a number of different people, including McCarthy and Tully, have highlighted that there's a way that the structure of perpetual peace that he's putting forward, even if it condemns empire, requires that its history would have taken place. And I think this is the way that the theodicy can actually be quite problematic, can actually be quite troubling in relation to both historical injustice and then also looking forward, one who's invoking these different structures, and then two, what do these different structures then end up enabling as they're deployed? I'd say at the end of the day, what I mean is what Kant has put forward in Peace is a political weapon, and precisely as a political and discursive weapon, it exceeds the ethical and the moral, and we need to be attentive to the histories of its deployments and its relationships to these different developmental hierarchies, to the different ways that it can sanitize, and to the different forms of violence to which it can then be put forward. And one can be quite Kantian about doing that, I think. So this is not a rejection or a refusal of Kant as a whole, but rather it's drawing out how the discourse on peace in Kant has these fundamental ambiguities and ambivalences that open up into different formations of war, violence, and empire.
Yeah, I think Tully's wrong about the
Tully overstates his case.
Well, I mean, part of it, you know, I mean, so the point for Kant, past evils are still evils. They may be necessary evils, but they're still evils. And so it might open up the possibility of some kind of reparations, even on his view. And it certainly does not sanitize the past. I mean, Kant is quite emphatic that the past... we're almost at an hour and a half here, Murad. I'm sorry, I got out of a rabbit hole with Kant here.
No worries. Sure. But let me just say that... it doesn't sanitize it in the sense of saying this is no longer an injustice, but what it does do is present it as part of the natural history of humanity. And it's precisely in naturalizing it and presenting it as the overarching direction of history and progress through all these brutal wars, we end up finally getting to peace. Whether we're including the language of reparations and things of the sort, it nonetheless, I think, remains the case that the broader and overarching theorization is precisely in thinking about how the institutions and the desire for peace comes to be spread. It's something that has to be affirmed. So we can say that Kant actually here is perhaps being a good Nietzschean in saying, yes, I affirm everything that has happened, sort of go forward. But I would nonetheless want to highlight how the developmentalism and its geography ends up presenting Europe as the center in relation to whether it's the Arabian Bedouins or the colonies that are dispossessed, or the happy inhabitants of Tahiti, who he says are resting in their peaceful indolence, and nonetheless rests on this hierarchy.
I think on those points we agree. I mean, Kant is a theorist. He does think that the natural condition of human beings is inequality and war and suffering. In that way, he might be right. I think into the background is some of this when I read this. Well, Steven Pinker had that book about the better angels of our nature, and you know, law. You know, basically, in an attempt to sort of empirically defend some of the Kantian Enlightenment view about the natural. You could say the sort of Hobbesian view of human nature and the sort of progressive account of history that we can tell that, you know, homicides have gone down over history, wars have gone down over history. And this is a, this is a good thing. Let's conclude, because I don't want to take up all your time. Let's conclude by, you know, you mentioned at the beginning you had sort of few alternative views of peace. Maybe you could just sort of contrast your view with say Kant or with Plato, and pick one of your different views and say what you think a better way forward for the ideal of peace.
Sure. So, and this is literally 2.5 pages at right, the end of the right. book. So, it's, just to be clear, it's not it's not sort of the primary set of arguments of the book. But I do end with that in order to indicate that I don't think that the structures that I've described are inherent, though I do think that they are persistent. And I think that that's an important distinction. But we can talk about the truce, for example, that I suggest is a concept that has been denigrated across the history of political thought, particularly in thinkers contrasting it with peace, where we can say that perpetuity and the universality of peace precisely comes about through its contrast with the truce as limited, as finite, but I would say also as renouncing the vision or the desire for these kinds of grand theories of the human, these grand theories of the globe, and these untenable, I think, visions of humanity moving forward. These incredibly, I think, troubling structures. So one thing that I say is rehabilitating the truce precisely as requiring us to question and also put aside these desires. And the truce is something that I think it'd be difficult for us to idealize or to moralize in the way that we do with the idea of peace, which for me is precisely part of what makes it particularly attractive, particularly necessary. And for a smaller kind of example, I also suggest the idea of a particular peace, or of speaking of peace in the particular, rather than talking about peace, as I think we have been at different moments in these broad, general, and moral terms, training ourselves to talk about peace in the concrete, to refer to the peace of X, Y, and Z, or the peace between this group and that group, just as a kind of small thing that might help us orient ourselves towards the world rather than towards these broader ideals that then end up doing all kinds of work in the world that we ourselves might not want to see, that we ourselves might be troubled when we see them being deployed in these ways. Here's where thinking back to how at the beginning of our conversation about American discourses surrounding enemies of peace or the aim of war, of a particular war being peace more generally, it would help us, I think, look at these kinds of claims with, at the very least, greater skepticism. And more ambitiously, perhaps by diagnosing these as compulsions that have come to constitute both the modern subject and the modern subject's desires and the broader epistemic structures that we often find ourselves inhabiting.
Well, Murad, this has been a really enjoyable conversation. And so thank you for letting me subject you to my questions. And
no, thank you
for joining
me.
This
is a lot of fun. I really appreciate you taking the time. And thanks also to the listeners. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.